Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we explore the strange sport of competitive eating with the author of a new book called Horsemen of the Esophagus, Competitive Eating and the Big Fat American Dream. We talk to the inventor of an unusual electronic instrument called the Continuum Fingerboard, and we hear how it's played. And we visit with Dixie Evans, famed 1950s burlesque dancer and head of Exotic World, the burlesque museum. The museum has recently moved from the deserts of California to the bright lights of Las Vegas. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. The Continuum Fingerboard is an electronic instrument that can produce sounds that many other instruments are capable of, yet it contains no keys, buttons, or strings. Instead, it relies on a complicated network of more than 200 aluminum rods, magnets, springs made from piano wire, and an internal computer, all contained beneath a fabric surface. Pressing down on the surface and the amount of pressure applied changes the resonance of the pitch it produces. The fingerboard is the vision of University of Illinois Electrical and Computer Engineering professor Lippold Hocken, who's been perfecting it for more than 20 years. Jeff Bossert spoke with Hocken and also with one in a handful of artists who have only started mastering the instrument.
With the fingerboard hooked up to a large keyboard, Mark Smart, an electronics technician and local jazz guitarist, demonstrates a saxophone sound.
Basically, it's set up so that the left to right direction is controlling pitch, and then when you push harder, the pressure is controlling the volume and also the brightness of the sound to try to imitate the way the saxophone gets brighter when you blow harder on it. And then I also have the front back direction is controlling growl. If you play toward yourself, you get a clean sound, and if you play farther away, you get kind of a growl. And this actual sound is coming from this keyboard over here, which is basically a Windows PC in a box with the keyboard.
All the saxophone sound, all whatever you want to emulate, this comes from the keyboard.
Yeah, the Continuum itself is a controller. It's not a synthesizer, so it just sends MIDI, which is a musical instrument digital interface, to control some other unit that actually produces the sound. It's really good for doing saxophone sounds and also for imitating Eddie Van Halen.
In order to produce a variety of sounds, Professor Lippold Hocken says he took his musical background and applied what he knew.
I wanted to do something in music and use my engineering skills doing it. And I'd been, my parents had me play violin all through my youth, and so I'm, you know, in violin playing, the vibrato is really important. Swells during notes, like crescendos during notes and glissandi and such, are all really important for expression. So I wanted to build an instrument that was keyboard-like, but had the same sort of expressive capabilities. And that's really where it came from.
Did you have a concept of what you wanted to do? Is this something that... You saw the final product?
Well, actually, I tried a lot of different approaches. The idea of just having a surface where you place your fingers and you have to place them exactly to get the right pitch, sort of like on a fretless guitar or on a violin fingerboard, that idea I had really early on, but how to actually build electronics for it was tough. And I went through a lot of different designs. The challenge there from the electronic side is that when you play a vibrato, you're only moving your finger a fraction of a millimeter. And it has to be able to track that, and has to be able to track that for lots of different fingers. And that's nobody's built a device that can do that yet.
And what kind of effects were you trying to pull off that would otherwise require holding down on some effect up here on a keyboard?
Right, and a keyboard player does that. A keyboard player has a pitch wheel, but that affects all the notes in the chord the same. It doesn't have the same sort of freedom. It sounds more... electronic, more mechanical than it does if each finger is vibrating individually. And all these things that you can do in a fretless string instrument, you can also do on this instrument.
How long did it take to finish this?
Well, I guess I started, I was with a group of students building music synthesizers and keyboards and also a pitch extractor, a thing that tracks singing. I was doing that in the early 80s when I was just finishing up my undergraduate and starting graduate school. So I think 84 is the first time I really wrote up the idea.
Can you name something that's easier to play now and what you wanted to emulate?
Oh, actually, easier to play is an interesting thing. You know, people always expect electronics to make their life easier, and in synthesizers, it's especially that way. One of the big frustrations for keyboard players is they sit down and play this instrument, doesn't play like a keyboard, and they don't like that. It's rare to find somebody who'll take the time and really realize that, no, this is a new instrument. I'm a keyboard player. If I were to start playing violin now, I could expect to spend years learning it. This is maybe not that big a leap, but it's a pretty big leap. Certainly the idea wasn't to make it easier. It was more to, like I say, to bring something of what you have, say, in the singing voice or in violin, in all those instruments where vibrato is so important and glissando is so important.
Fully utilizing the keyboard, Mark Smart records a bass line from the fingerboard, then adds to it. Professor Hawkins, as many others, have contributed to the fingerboard while he built it the last few years.
It was one of many projects. It was sort of a back burner thing. It was a big enough project that sort of went in fits and starts. But I would run into people and tell them about the idea, and people would have an idea of different kinds of sensing devices to use, different kinds of technology to use. And also, not being a very good performing musician myself, I really need a musician's feedback. Because almost all the improvements since like the last 6 or 7 years have been performers asking for changes. It's not like if you get a grand piano, but there's all these piano technique books that you can follow, and you can go a step-by-step program and learn how to play piano. There's no such thing for this, so a lot of it's sort of your own discovery.
One of my most obvious questions, I mean, everybody's got to learn this thing by trial and error. I mean, it's not as if there's a continuum fingerboard teacher out there.
That's right, and also people all have very different playing styles. It's just now beginning that some of the continuum fingerboard players are imitating others, but that's really a new thing. It's still a small enough thing that most people develop their own playing technique, and most people play very different styles of music.
Yeah, how does this relate to what you do on campus?
Well, it's very nice. The interest of the students is very good. There's a lot of students, partly just because of iPods and such, that hear a lot of music, and then so they'll be fans of some of the bands. There's certainly some very very loyal Dream Theater fans here that I've run into. So the students like to see, when I'm teaching a class, right, it's interesting for them that this band that they listen to willingly on their own, that they really enjoy, that I contributed something there. So I'm hoping that over time I can help nurture that, the next generation of people that are going to go out and do the cutting-edge new things and get that mix of electrical engineering and music.
Dream Theater is a progressive metal band that uses the continuum fingerboard. Other more familiar names of those who have taken up the instrument include John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin fame and Terry Lawless, a keyboardist with U2. The fingerboard was also recently used for sound effects in Steven Spielberg's remake of War of the Worlds. Professor Hawken and Mark Smart have been to some trade shows with the instrument, but with a retail value between $3,000 and $5,500, depending on the model, Hawken says he doesn't want to add the expense of paying a distributor. And Hawken says he didn't design the continuum fingerboard to get rich, adding he has realistic expectations for an instrument that will take some time for others to learn about, not to mention figure out how to play. I'm Jeff Bossert. We'll be right back.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Every year on the 4th of July at Nathan's Hot Dogs in Coney Island, a strange event takes place. People from around the world gather together to see how many hot dogs they can eat in 12 minutes. It's the premier event in the world of competitive eating. The people who compete in this unusual sport are profiled in a new book by author Jason Fagone called Horsemen of the Esophagus, Competitive Eating and the Big Fat American Dream. It's published by Crown Books. I spoke to Fagone recently and asked him to first explain the sport of competitive eating.
It's something that harkens back to our American picnic time tradition. We used to have pie contests in every small town on the 4th of July, along with the catching of the greased pig and a reading of the Declaration of Independence, sort of a bit of Americana. And in 1997, the International Federation of Competitive Eating was founded in New York. That's the organized league that sponsors about 100 contests a year all around the country. And initially, the IFOCE was founded as sort of a joke, as a satire. It was a satire of American mainstream sport. It was a way to lampoon the NFL and Major League Baseball and their sort of crybaby, spoiled, million-dollar-earning athletes like Barry Bonds and Terrell Owens. And what happened is the competitive eaters themselves showed up and started taking it seriously, and they transformed the whole phenomenon. And today it's really a corporate thing. It's corporate, and there's money, and it's very, very serious.
Well, do you consider it a sport, or is it entertainment? So, I mean, I'm asking, is it football, baseball, or is it professional wrestling?
Yeah, the chairman of the IFOCE, a guy named George Shea, who is sort of half P.T. Barnum and half Karl Rove. He's a PR genius of the latter half of the 21st century. He calls it a show/sport. Me, I'm ambivalent about, you know, whether it's really a sport. I allow, you know, the readers to decide. But, you know, I did go to 27 contests in 13 states and two continents over the course of a year reporting this book. And, you know, what I found was that, you know, competitive eating has become a valid avenue for the American second act. You know, that old saying that American lives always have a second act. Well, this is a new kind of second act, and the eaters that I focused on tended to see competitive eating as a solution to a certain kind of midlife crisis or quarter-life crisis. I thought that was fascinating.
What sorts of foods are we talking about? What are the most popular things that people eat competitively, and how much do they eat?
Well, there's really no food that can't be put into contest form. You know, they eat hot dogs, chicken wings, jambalaya, oysters, eggs, fruitcake, baked beans, tiramisu, cheesecake, every category of food from meats to sweets. And, you know, the best eaters tend to focus on the hot dog contest because it's the longest running contest. The Nathan's famous hot dog contest on Coney Island on the 4th of July. And also just for purely benchmark reasons, you know, if you can get a good hot dog number, that means you can compare your eating prowess among the other gurgitators, so-called gurgitators.
Now, you mentioned Nathan's hot dog contest, the one that is actually the one that gets all the press. But there's another contest that you feature in the book that seems to be just as huge, and this is the wing bowl.
Right. The wing bowl is lesser known, but I think more interesting. And, you know, it's bigger in terms of live audience, not in terms of the media. Nathan's hot dog contest gets media all over the world, but Wing Bowl is a local event. Still, 20,000 people show up to watch it live in the Wachovia Center, which is where the Philadelphia 76ers play. You know, 20,000 people at 6 a.m. in the morning, a lot of them inebriated, and they are there to watch fat guys eat chicken wings. It's sort of a singular kind of thing, and it's unique to Philadelphia here. I live here, and it's really become something akin to a civic event. We had, our U.S. congressmen attend. They get tickets. We had Arlen Specter go one year. We had our mayor, Ed Rendell, actually give out the prizes for a couple of years during Wing Bowl's development. It's like nothing else.
Now, who are the people who actually do this? And I guess the big question is, what makes them do it?
Right. I thought when I started working on this that I would find a bunch of freaks and sort of media whores and career eccentrics and crazy people. But what shocked me is that they really aren't. For the most part, the competitive eaters are pretty normal. You know, they're as normal as Americans in campaign commercials. They are construction workers and social workers, doctors, lawyers, stockbrokers, and the ones that I focused on tended to be using competitive eating for the same kinds of things that all of us are looking for. You know, they're looking for some expertise and some fair competition and something to talk about with a group of friends over beers and a way to shine a little bit, some attention. A way to get a pat on the back, make your wife and your kids proud. You know, literally, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness through organized competitive gluttony.
Well, you talk about quite a few of them specifically, and I guess we can't really talk about, you know, the competitive eating circuit and the Nathan's Hot Dog Contest without talking about Kobayashi, the famed Japanese eater who just does an incredible amount of eating at these contests.
Kobayashi is inhuman and incredible in all of those things. He's a 28-year-old guy, and he remade the phenomenon of competitive eating in 2001 when, as a skinny little kid, he came to Coney Island completely under the radar. Nobody knew who he was, and he doubled the prior hot dog record. He ate 50 hot dogs that day in 12 minutes. And, he ate so many that the people who were holding up numbers, indicating the number of hot dogs that he had eaten, actually ran out of numbers, and they had to write his new numbers with Sharpie markers on the backs of existing cards. And he's still around. He comes to Coney Island every year and tries to beat his prior record. And in the book, I travel to Japan for 2 weeks with an American eater named David Kundago Karma. And we tried to get an interview with the elusive Kobayashi and learn his secret.
Kundog is a really interesting character in your book because he's a guy who kind of fell into this early on and got that taste of local fame. And then it sparked the rest of his interest and just kept him going.
Right, yeah. No, Kundog is endlessly fascinating to me. He's probably my favorite eater, even though he's not the most prestigious or the most talented necessarily. He's a guy who is not the Nathan's Hot Dog champion, but he's the tag team bratwurst champion of Canton, Ohio, among other titles. And you're right, Kundog, when he was when he was in grade school, he did a local TV show and ate pizza against a local champ, and he won. And it sort of gave him the taste. And then many years later, he found himself in the midst of sort of a midlife crisis. His life wasn't going the way he hoped it would. He was getting older. He hadn't really achieved his dream to be a writer. And he saw a tabloid article about the International Federation of Competitive Eating, and it launched him on this sort of journey onto the circuit.
And also what I really appreciate is he had a plan. with you involved to friendly kidnap Kobayashi away from Nathan's, the hot dog contest, and take him to a baseball game.
Right. Yeah, we kidnapped the hot dog champ, basically, after Coney Island this year. We wanted to take him to a game, partly because Kobe loves baseball, and you know, partly because we wanted to see how people would react to him. And I think also, subconsciously, Coondog and I may have wanted to see what it was like if, you know, this classic sort of American sport combined and clashed against this weird new kind of grotesque American sport. And it turned out it was totally natural. We took him to an Indians game at Jacobs Field, and the TV cameras found him. They filmed him in his seat eating a hot dog twice and put it up on the Jumbotron. It was amazing the palpable need of people to watch this guy eat a hot dog, buy him a hot dog, just laughing and, you know, just really enjoying him.
Well, in your book, you seem really torn at what the message of competitive eating is. On one hand, you have this display of American gluttony, and then on the other, you have this existential search for meaning. So where is it?
Right. Well, that's what's so fascinating, right? I mean, initially, for me, there was this visual of an eating contest, and it seemed like this perfect caricature of everything that people fear and hate about America, you know, this gluttonous, kind of dumb, imbecilic, spectacle-hungry country. And that's the question I kept asking myself in the book, you know, does this mean anything? If so, what does it mean? Is there something dark at the heart of the American character as expressed through this spectacle of an eating contest? Or is this actually an expression of, you know, the better side of the American spirit, our entrepreneurial resilience and, you know, our kind of courage to be shameless that, you know, many throughout the world have admired over the years? And, you know, it's a complicated question, and I took, 300 pages to answer it, but, you know, where I landed was at this ball game, a Cleveland Indians game at Jacobs Field with David Coondog Okarma and Takeru Kobayashi.
That was Jason Fagoni, author of Horsemen of the Esophagus, Competitive Eating, and the Big Fat American Dream. It's published by Crown Books.
Potatoes, Ma. I don't want no meat, I don't want no meat, just more potatoes.
You're listening to Sidetrack. There are those who consume books, and for an afternoon in Urbana, there was an event where one could actually consume books. It was the latest addition to what's become an annual event around the world, an April Fool's Day tribute to gourmets, artists, and bibliophiles everywhere. AM580's Tom Rogers takes us to the Edible Books Festival at the University of Illinois' Illini Union.
Author Jean-Anthelme Briot-Savarin told his contemporaries, "Tell me what you eat, and I will tell you what you are." You could call his most famous book, The Physiology of Taste, a sort of early 19th century Food Network program. He was born on April 1st, a perfect time, thought archivist and critic Judith Hofberg, sitting at a Thanksgiving dinner with a few artist friends, to mix Savarin's interest in food with her interest in literature, and do it whimsically.
We're sitting around, of course, mellow with wine and food, and talking about books, and one thing led to food, and then I put the two together just in lightning speed. I said, gee, wouldn't it be an interesting idea to do something about edible books? And then we all went home.
The next year, 2000, Hofberg held her first Edible Books High-Low Tea in Los Angeles. 6 years later, it's an event in 15 countries, and U of I librarians have now taken the idea and run with it.
pretty much reached your decisions?
I'm just now going to put these down. Let's see.
You may know Doyle Moore as the chef-in-residence on our talk program, Focus 580. He was also the judge of the first CU Edible Books Festival. It was a challenge of wit as much as cooking and decorating skills. Some entries were simply book-shaped cakes. Others were more exotic, like sushi.
Then, well, no, this is not sushi. Check that out again. It's the dead seaweed scrolls. And so it's an extraordinarily good pun on the Dead Sea Scrolls and on sea and seaweed. And I find this particularly attractive because, again, it pushes some things a little bit farther than you would think about it.
There were small meat and cheese hors d'oeuvres in the shape of books and book titles in the shape of toast.
Putting the letters on top of a piece of toast and then toasting it, and then it comes out with the letters in negative, is very amusing because that's the whole abstract concept of photography.
The creator of the Toast of the Town happens to be a photographer. Down the table is a hollow cake that at first glance may have been damaged.
I mean, the book is controversial. It's on the Da Vinci Code.
Oh, yes.
But it seems to be cracked.
Well, it does seem to be cracked. I'm not so sure that that was an intention. I don't think so by the form of the crack, but it could be to crack the Da Vinci Code. It's smashed in at the top, but then it's not destroyed around the edges anywhere. So I can't imagine if something dropped on it or if somebody cracked the code.
It's a mystery.
So it is a mystery.
Just like the book.
Exactly. We'll not know.
Contest organizer Sue Searing entered a homemade pizza. Swirled in the center, in linguine, was the Dewey Decimal System number for pizza. A black olive served as the decimal point. These types of events are natural draws for librarians, but Searing says the whole community turned out.
About half of these entries are from art students, and the other half are from librarians, community members, students in other departments. We really weren't sure who was going to show up, and we're pretty excited to have this much interest. That's why we're holding it at the Union rather than at the library. Plus, of course, you're not supposed to eat in the library.
Doyle Moore's winner was a dough-based recreation of a quipu, a string of knotted cords that the Incans used as a sort of mnemonic to help them in storytelling. He was surprised that for an April Fool's event, most of the entries were not really foolish.
There's a lot of thought that goes into making the choice. Then the object itself can take its own humor, but there's a lot of attention paid to details, and I did not expect that careful a consideration, quite frankly.
But Moore and the festival's visitors did expect the eventual demise of this year's edible books as an afternoon snack. For Sidetrack, I'm Tom Rogers.
Still to come on the program, we check in with Illinois Poet Laureate, and we chat with 1950s burlesque star Dixie Evans. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. Kevin Stein is a very busy man. He's the Poet Laureate of Illinois. And even though he doesn't get paid for it, being Illinois' Poet Laureate is a full-time job. A job he loves. Jonathan All talked to Stein, who is also a professor of English at Bradley University in Peoria, about his projects as Poet Laureate and his new works.
Kevin Stein was named Poet Laureate of Illinois in 2002. He's only the fourth person to hold the position, following in the footsteps of legends Gwendolyn Brooks, Carl Sandburg, and Howard Austin. He says his schedule is filled with what you'd expect a poet laureate to do: poetry readings, organizing writing contests, and promoting the art form across the state. But he says there's also the occasional surprise, usually related to the misunderstanding about his unpaid position that has no project budget.
In fact, I had a fact checker call me from Chicago Magazine saying, we're doing one of those specials on what people make. And we were told as poet laureate, you make $35,000 a year, and we're just calling to check. And after I picked myself up from the floor and rolling with laughter, I explained that there wasn't a stipend and no project budget or whatever. And in fact, I have one of my first projects is a project called Poetry Now. And that basically is my going to out-of-the-way places, rural libraries, urban schools, wherever, colleges, universities, community colleges, and talking about poetry, reading some of my own, and then donating money to that library for the purchase of books by contemporary Illinois poets. That's important to me. If I convince or persuade anybody that contemporary poetry can be meaningful to them, then it makes sense to me to sort of plant the seed and then water it with a little cash. So I've been tithing, if you will. And so Chicago Magazine, I'm told, listed my salary as poet laureate as minus $1,500, which at that time was the amount of money that I had given away to fund the Poetry Now project. That's been a very successful project, and I'm happy if you go to the website, which is www.poetlaureate.il.gov, you'll see a list of the libraries and schools that have been recipient of Poetry Now funds, and then you also get to see the books and the authors listed whose books that they have purchased. Beyond that, Jonathan, I have, and I keep a running total of these, I have been a part of 66 events since I was named laureate. So that's since March of 2004. I've been in rural libraries, urban schools, I've been community colleges, nursing homes, universities, and last week I got the rare pleasure of reading in a factory in Kewaunee, Illinois. BOMAG Manufacturing. They make compaction equipment. And during the lunch hour, I got to read to the men and women who came in to eat their sandwich and hear poems.
What was that like?
It was wonderful. I don't know who was more surprised, they or me. And I think what was most wonderful is that folks who came off the assembly line came in, wiping their brows and with dirty hands, and folks came from the administrative offices, folks came from human resources. I had probably 35 or 40 people. They were very attentive. I tried to get out of there with just two poems, and sweetly, they said, no, read more. And so their 20 minutes became 25. They got an extra 5 minutes lunch. I got to read one more poem. This was important to me because I had worked a couple years in a factory to supplement my college scholarship. And I remember those guys who'd whisper in my ear over their coffee cup over our break. And they would say to me nightly, nearly, they would say, stay in school, kid. And so this allowed me or enabled me to kind of fulfill one of my great desires to go back to the factory and bring poems into that place.
You also said when you were appointed poet laureate that it was very important for you to continue being an active poet, writing new material. American Ghost Roses has been published. It's been out there for a little bit, but you have some new poems.
This is a crucial point for me because if one stops writing, but one goes around and talks about the importance of poetry, then one is a faker or living off one's laurels. And I didn't want that. Secondly, writing is important to me. It's like breathing, or it's the daily bread, if you will. And so I have been surprisingly successful at carving out time. My family's understanding. They know I'm a grump when I don't write, or at least try to write. I'm much happier writing, even if it's badly, than not writing at all. And so I'm pretty close to having a new manuscript together, and that's pretty quick. Usually it's a four to five year prospect. I think I've been, my poems are changing, though, because of the people that I meet and the kinds of things that I do. But I'm happy to say poems are still coming, yeah.
Why don't you read one for us?
This winter, I received a phone call from the Nielsen Association, those folks who do the TV ratings, and they asked if we would like to partake and be a Nielsen family. My family said, no, don't do that. That's awful. But of course, I agreed because it just seemed wonderful to me and delicious to be part of this sort of long tradition of American viewership. The oddest thing, once you agree, then they mail you all this stuff, and they mailed with it five $1 bills. Not a check for $5, but five $1 bills. Who's putting ones in the envelopes? Yeah? So this is my poem on being a Nielsen family. We pocket five ones when we agree. Fingered cash, our soul's ransom. And a family viewership record book for each TV, of which we've three. We are the postmodern Descartes. Pledging, I watch, therefore I am. We're the grand experiment that was America, both scientist and the mouse with a human ear stitched to its pink back, checking the appropriate idiot box boxes. We're our own peeping Tom, peering in. On stage, we're culture's disguise. The way a bickering couple makes nice once the bell ding-dongs neighbors in for cocktails and unsalted cheese nips. Though it's Oprah, we circle BBC News. Though Jerry Springer, we mark Charlie Rose. No, 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 not South Park, not Cops, not World's Funniest Animal Tricks, but History Channel and Discovery, NASA Live, Nightline, and Devotionals, the Food Network's Thanksgiving Day Vegan Special. We are watched, watching. Watching ourselves watched. We are never enough, and the lie is as we wish to be.
Kevin Stein reading his new poem on being a Nielsen family. Stein is the poet laureate and a professor of English at Bradley University. His latest collection of poems, entitled American Ghost Roses, is published by the University of Illinois Press. I'm Jonathan Aull.
Got attuned to Sidetrack. This year, Exotic World, the burlesque museum, has moved from its longtime home in the dusty deserts of California to the bright lights of Las Vegas. And later on this month, Exotic World will be holding its annual Miss Exotic World pageant and striptease reunion. The woman who runs Exotic World is famed 1950s burlesque dancer Dixie Evans, a gal who made her name as the Marilyn Monroe of burlesque. I recently sat down with Evans at her new residence in Las Vegas and asked her to talk about her career and Exotic World's recent move.
Moving out to Las Vegas has been a fabulous, wonderful experience. You can't find words to describe the awesomeness of what is out here. It is absolutely just huge. Everywhere you look, everything big. There's nothing bigger or brighter in the world than Las Vegas.
Bringing the museum out here.
The museum was a goat farm. Jenny Lee, a very famous tassel twirler, she could twirl tassels on her bazooms and on her derriere and do cartwheels around the stage. Well, she realized the importance of our era, which was burlesque. And a lot of the young people can't fathom a world without television. But there was a world out there before television, and we were in it. And all of us older dancers, when the war was over and the 50s was over and the 60s, we would congregate and have a little reunion. Well, this year, 2006, will be the 49th annual striptease reunion. And the Miss Exotic World pageant, which is only 17, 18 years old. However, the girls came from everywhere, way out there in that desert, and survived the heat. And once they came the next year, they'd save all year long their money to get a new costume, and it just grew and grew and got bigger and bigger. And the only thing is it was not able to totally sustain itself, you know, because if I'd want to give the musicians $100 and give little, the $100 is just by the time you add up the receipts and what you spent with paint to put them on, you know, a lot of people that have put events on, they know what it costs to put it on. So at any rate, we struggled. And then there just came a time when we realized we have to go where there are people. And they suggested Las Vegas, and we said, okay, here we go. So we still have a lot of things in storage, and we still have a lot of things out at the museum. And I don't know, we've had press and different ones come from Las Vegas, and I've had people drive all the way over there to see that museum, most of the older people. Because, see, Sally Rand is an American icon, and a lot of people don't even know the name Sally Rand. The young people don't, and some of the young people do, and they say, I heard that name in the windmills of my mind, and I have the original fans of Sally Rand that saved Chicago. And Sally Rand lived in my mind from the time I was very young, and I just had the hankering. But anyway, when Jenny died, I went out there to help unpack things. We only had one little room in the living room, and the museum was a goat shed. But we finally wound up with 8 rooms, 12 glass counters, Gypsy Rose Lee's trunks. We have a lot of memorabilia and still collecting. So we just have to move to Vegas. And when I say have to, fortunately, it's the best thing and the best place for us to be.
You know, let's move away from talking about the museum and talk about you in particular.
Oh.
And, I mean, you know, for people who don't know, tell us about, you know, how you got started.
Okay.
And, you know, how you developed as a burlesque star.
Okay. Well, I always had the hankering to be in show business when I was very, very, very young. It was in the 30s, and I saw a big article about the Rockettes in New York. And I thought, if I ever get old enough and get money to get to New York, I'm going to be a Rockette. I didn't know you had to be a good dancer, and I got to see the Rockettes in the 50s, but I know I had this hankering, and my daddy was an oil man, and they used to have poker games a lot, you know, and the oil men like to play poker. And so I'd run in the bedroom, and they would have a break sometimes, and the women would make sandwiches, and I'd get out a little top hat or an old straw hat, and I'd entertain, and I'd pass the hat around, and I'd get a few pennies, a nickel maybe or two. And this hankering never left. So I just started teaching dancing, which I couldn't dance, but Anyway, so I started doing little modeling and figure studies and anything I could get just to try to stay in touch with show business. And I finally got a job up in San Francisco called a page. When a big show opens up, you the two girls or two boys, whatever they hire, you walk open with the curtain as the curtain opens, and then you thrust your hand and the big star bursts out. Show lasted 2 weeks, went broke, no money, can't get back to Los Angeles. And the girl says, come on, let's go down this club. And I went down this club, down these stairs, you know. And oh, there was a girl, she had a big cowboy hat on and white fur chaps, and she was bumping and shooting these guns off. And oh, and everything looked so glamorous and wonderful. And a fella came over and he punched me in the shoulder and he said, I want you to cut your act short this show and get out and mix a little more. And I said, I don't work here. He said, you don't? Do you want to work here? And I ran up the stairs, and they have mimes in San Francisco out in front of the clubs. And he said to this mime we had, get that girl. Don't let her get away. And he's chasing me a couple blocks up San Francisco. And he said, this is really a nice place. The boss wants to meet you at 2 o'clock at this chop suey joint, and I met him at 2 o'clock, and the noodles were flying and flying, and he had his fork shaking in my, you want to make money, blah, blah, blah. So he gave me $10 to get a costume, and I went out and bought a sheer pink nightgown and a big pink pillow. And my first act was Mr. Sandman, Bring Me a Dream, and I had the big pillow. And So anyway, I'd lay back over. The sailors were coming back from the war and do backbends in their face and wander through the audience. So then somebody said, you know what? What do you? And my boss, he said, you know when you drink that champagne, you don't spill a drop, do you? And I said, no, sir, I don't. He said, then spill it. You're only supposed to order it. Don't drink it. And so he said, you're always trying to do a new act, a new number, coming down in the daytime, rehearsing. He said, you got to go back east where they hire you for your act and what you do and not mixing in the club. So when I went back east, I got on the circuit, and my God, those big theaters. And of course, the era did end. I wasn't in it that long, the burlesque era, but it was really wonderful.
Well, tell me about how you developed your Marilyn Monroe act, the one that you're famous for.
Okay. Well, I went to New York, and I was known as the Southern Comfort Girl. And I went on stage, and my own act that I had developed myself, when I come on stage with dark glasses and a long cigarette holder and furs, and I say, well, it just wasn't that easy to become a movie star. I had to walk and walk and knock on every agent's door till I thought I would drop. But somehow, I just had to reach the top. Well, I did that, but I did myself. I wasn't doing Marilyn. I had a movie, a producer's chair, a movie, red velvet couch, and I had made camera. I didn't make it. Someone in Hollywood did make me a perfect look, just had MGM. So at any rate, I would stroll on stage, you know, and I did this act trying to break into the pictures. And I would go over to the producer's chair, and I never once let anyone in that audience think that there wasn't someone sitting in that chair. I knew that I had to walk around the chair, and then I'd go, oh, and then finally, big drum roll, and I'd point to the big camera, screen test, and I'd run over there and do a little screen test. Then I'd run back, like I got the job, and then I'd scream, I didn't get the job, and I'd throw myself on the floor and throw a violent tantrum, kicking and crying and everything. And then we had a great song in my era, Just One More Chance, da, da, da. And I would crawl on my hands and knees over to the producer's chair, begging and pleading. And then all of a sudden the drum roll would go, and I would slowly look at the big red velvet couch. Oh, you and me. Oh. And I'd cry again and trip over there. And then, wow, drum solo, worked that couch over so real it frightened me even. And then, of course, I had strip nets under here, and then I would wave my black pants in the audience, and then I'd go over and sign a big movie contract and stroll off. So when Mr. Minsky saw me do that act, he said, "You look like Marilyn Monroe when you do that act. I'm going to call you the Marilyn Monroe of burlesque." I said, "Mr. Minsky, everybody in Hollywood looks like Marilyn." He said, "It doesn't matter. You know, we've got all kinds of people in New York, Puerto Ricans and this one, and they see Marilyn Monroe's name real big. They're going to buy a ticket and run in, you know." So at any rate, so then I really had to do Marilyn better and better every solitary night. And if there'd be a picture of her on the front page of the Time magazine or whatever it was, I'd go right straight to the mirror, bright purple lipstick, da-da-da, whatever, platinum blonde hair, wiggle this way. So it was a wonderful experience in show business, and I owe everything to Marilyn. And one day I saw her on a stretcher going to the hospital in New York, and I said to my boss, I said, "I cannot go on tonight, Sam. It's just horrible." He said, "Are you kidding?" Oh, he went on and on and on. He said, "This is business we got." I said, "All right, only one way I'll go on. I'm going to send a telegram." He said, "She'll never get it. Here's the keys to the office. Lock it up when you get back." I have no idea what I said in the telegram. No idea. But about 2 weeks later, just 2 weeks, there was an envelope in my dressing room. It said, "My dear, dear Dixie Evans, of my many friends and fans throughout the entire world, your telegram was of the greatest comfort to me at this time. Marilyn Monroe Miller." I ran out to the bar and I said, "See, Sam, she did answer." And then he took it away from me and he ran all up and down the bar. "See, look, I told her to call, write Marilyn." But it was getting towards the end of Marilyn, I could feel it. See, I lived Marilyn every inch of the day, of the night, for some reason. It just was obsessed with me. And I was married to a prize fighter at the time, and he was doing fairly well, not fighting at this time. He'd gone into something else. And I said, "You know what? I want to quit, but I can't. I can't quit doing Marilyn. What if Marilyn believes that she's washed up?" Because I tell you what happened. All of a sudden, I noticed Brigitte Bardot, the new sex kitten, Brigitte Bardot, and I said, "They're putting the worst pictures of Marilyn in the newspaper." And I said, "You know, the press, you know, they're trying to bring her down." And I said, "So what'll she think if I quit?" "I would not do it." No, I said, I felt that close to her that in my own little teeny-eeny-weeny way, I would really want to just protect Marilyn and keep Marilyn. Yeah, we were just, it was something I had to do. But, my career, in my opinion, I was really happy when I was actually on the stage doing my act, but it isn't all quite so glamorous. You do come into different things and ways of life. And then, of course, when Marilyn died, I died. The guilt was so bad. I just went into the most horrible depression. I didn't grieve for my lost career. It was Marilyn is gone from the world forever. But at any rate, time moves on. And now, for some reason, burlesque is back. And the new young girls have found something. Because a lot of them came to me and said, "Oh, I want to be a dancer." I said, "Honey, there's no money in it. The pole clubs and the dancers, no. We want to be an entertainer." I said, "Well, the only ones that make it are the ones that don't quit." And lo and behold, two of my, Lita Von Teese and Catherine and a lot of the others, they just stuck to their guns and went back to doing striptease. And it's exciting, and they come up with, we had 126 dancers on the last show in the desert. They come up with gimmicks, things like I did, you know, way back, cute acts, all kinds of cute numbers. And they just keep coming and coming and coming. So a person still gets to see a beautiful girl, a sexy girl, take off her clothes, and interesting at the same time. And I am shocked to find out some of them are writers and some of them are artists. And I mean, they're really very talented bunch of kids out there today. A lot. Oh.
So, you know, what now for burlesque? You know, where do you think it's going to go? What now for Dixie Evans?
Well, I think burlesque will stay around for a long, long time because of the invention of these kids coming up with different, unusual things all the time. And you never know what they're going to do. I'm just amazed when they just come running up and say, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. I say, no, I thank you because you kids are coming out there to that desert, putting up with the heat and everything to get on that stage. No, we love it. We like coming out here. Thank you. So I do believe that I didn't actually create it or start it. I think Madonna probably did the first open the door sort of to the old industry, because she did bring up something about Marilyn and the clothes and everything. So I didn't start it. But as far as collecting it, the boxes and boxes and boxes of photographs, unbelievable, from all of the very big famous stars from way back. Oh, yes.
And you're just going to keep going.
Yes, I'm going to keep going as long as I can, yeah. Yeah, we've got so much memorabilia. Like I said, Sally's fans, Gypsy Rose Lee's trunks and costumes. Oh, and Blaze Star, big name movie. I'm in touch with Blaze Star quite a bit, and her gown that was worn in the motion picture Blaze. And I have the hat that was Marilyn Monroe costumes, too. And I had an Oscar made for Marilyn Monroe. You're not supposed to copy a achievement award, but I did because Marilyn deserves an Oscar. And if they want to sue me, hey, come on. Marilyn is going to live forever.
And hopefully Dixie Evans as well.
Oh, thank you very much. I hope so.
That was Dixie Evans, 1950s burlesque star and head of Exotic World, the Burlesque Museum. Both her and the museum have recently moved to Las Vegas. Later on this month, they will be hosting the annual Miss Exotic World pageant and striptease reunion. For more information, visit their website at exoticworldusa.org. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. And you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.EDU, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.